Hello and welcome to Unfrozen episode number 86. I'm your co-host Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik. Today our guest is Jeffrey Huber. He is a principal with Brooks and Scarpa Architects and the author of the recent book Salty Urbanism, which is a concept that is going to have to be deployed rather assiduously in the next few years in the region in which he works, which is Fort Lauderdale in South Florida. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
As an act of full disclosure, as Jeffrey and I were discussing before the recording began, he and I don't know each other, but we had both been working for the same firm at one time or another. I was working for an earlier iteration, Pugh and Scarpa, until about 2011, and Jeffrey came on full time with the reformatted Brooks and Scarpa in 2014, opening up their Fort Lauderdale office. The work we're here to talk about today, though, is this design concept called salty urbanism. Maybe we can just start at the top. How would you define salty urbanism, and how does it compare to, you know, other sort of do we stay the course or do we retreat kind of discussions around the rapid advance of sea levels in your region?
Yeah, I mean, one of the main reasons we wrote this book and published it was to be optimistic about our future and be optimistic about the places, I think, that are faced and threatened by future sea level rise. South Florida seems to be kind of at ground zero for that in the United States. But, you know, we put together this manual essentially to be a visual guide and a design tool and a framework for any designers, but also general or lay audiences to kind of utilize it and move that forward. So, you know, from that standpoint, it's optimistic, but it's also retooling us around a world of water and really to think about how we live on with and over it. That's the critical need that we saw, and it's really about how do we tie architectural, urban design, landscape architectural, and even engineering tools together to address that.
You go into quite a lot of detail about the varied hydrological cross sections of South Florida, if you will. Can you talk a little bit about how you did that research and broke apart the segments of the different types of soil? I think a lot of people just think of, okay, well, it's uniformly flat and that's all there is to it, but it's quite a bit more complex than that.
Oh, absolutely. 1 inch can change a lot of things in South Florida. most people don't think about elevation in that way, but it's really almost game changing in a lot of aspects. And so what we did, the first thing, you know, and just to kind of preface this, I'm an architect and a landscape architect, but the role that we looked at here was to really understand the ecology, the geology, and the hydrology. You almost have to go back to the past. I mean, what we see out there right now is essentially cosmetic surgery. It's the built environment is literally just built on what was once there. And so in order to understand it, we went through a kind of forensic ecology, looking at four different main ecotypes in South Florida. And those four main ecotypes were the kind of upland pineland ridges, you know, where all the hardwood hammocks were, where the pinelands were, which is really the areas that aren't as susceptible to flooding. But it's important, especially in future sea level rise, to understand those soil conditions, to understand also that you need to get those areas right in order not to exacerbate flooding in the lower lying areas in these other ecotypes, which, you know, the other ecotypes that we worked with in are the Barrier Island, which actually has a great a cross-section of elevation. In Broward County, where I am, our highest elevation is 22 foot above sea level, and that's only about 0.25% of the land area can even be considered that. A majority of our land area is only about 3 feet above sea level. And so, you know, when we look at the uplands or these kind of coastal barrier islands, you know, we have about 14 foot is about the highest elevation on the barrier island, and it goes down to some cases 1 foot above sea level. And so there's a really good transect out there in this kind of ecotype. And so we studied really how, you know, the landscape, how, again, the geology, the ecology, and the hydrology of those areas work. But we also looked at the transverse glades, which is, ironically, these areas that kind of go between the pineland or these kind of hardwood hammock ridges. And it's where the Everglades connected to the ocean previously. So those have another kind of. If you look and study the map of South Florida, you'll see the canal. position to build upon, which was really first developed because of agriculture, but then became urban areas. Those canals have never been expanded. You know, like if you think about it, we've expanded highways to deal with traffic, but we never expanded these canals. So this is where we have a lot of the flooding issues in these low-lying areas around these transverse glades. And then we have the Everglades, which I think a lot of people understand. And in Broward County, if you, again, look at a map of the region, anything west of I-95 was once the Everglades. And I always love Bobby Stroud, who is the former executive director for the Southeast Florida Water Management District, always said, anything west of I-95 was once the Everglades, and when it rains, it remembers it, you know, because those areas are highly susceptible to flooding, but they're also sitting on very organic materials over time, and then also all of it is sitting on a porous limestone substrate, right? And so this porous limestone substrate is what really creates the challenges for South Florida. You know, whether it has some of that organic matter on top of it, or it's been built up because of the way the old, you know, when we had future or past rising seas, you know, how those would create more coral reefs and kind of create some of these higher conditions. I mean, all of it is why we can't build levees and dikes to kind of protect us from flooding like most other areas in the country or around the world. You know, essentially we flood from below. You know, we flood from above and we flood from the side, but the flood from below is the biggest challenge with that porous limestone substrate.
Maybe getting into the aspects of, okay, then how do we tackle this hydrology with design? You've kind of broken it down into urban design considerations, sort of ecological engineering considerations, and then the sort of architectural considerations. Could you sort of give us sort of the headline of what you think that, say, top three strategies are in any of those categories that are contained within this book? And then we can talk about what other people have suggested that we do with South Florida and other coastal regions that are quickly becoming difficult to insure, amongst other things.
You know, absolutely. I mean, you know, we really did create a tool set that was fundamental around ecology, urban design, and architectural kind of strategies. You know, and from that standpoint, the ecological ones, I mean, I always get asked this question, you know, from especially mayors or city commissioners, like, what should I be doing now? Well, it's plant trees. You know, if there's something simple to do, it's plant a tree. But, you know, what we try to talk about in the book from an ecological standpoint is the right tree in the right place. You know, and we need to really kind of consider, you know, is it a freshwater tree species? Is it a saltwater tree species? Can it handle saltwater inundation? And I'm not talking about just salt spray on the ocean. I'm talking about its feet wet in salt. And so we really fundamentally understand that mangroves are one of those main trees, but we talk about there's other urban street trees we use in our context, like the green buttonwood. That's a great one here in South Florida that can mitigate trees. The awesome thing about the green buttonwood, it also sits there in its feet with its feet wet. And these are called pretty much phreophatic tree species. So anybody, even outside of South Florida, I mean, even though salty urbanism has a South Florida water or a plant palette, you can kind of take these tactics and tools to your community. Because if you look at these bottomland kind of wetland dwelling species, whether they be on a coastline or whether they be in a wetland, freshwater wetland condition, these are the phreophatic trees that are going to be the smart trees to kind of use in the future in our urban conditions that are facing these kind of elements. So, you know, the green buttonwood, for instance, is one of these trees that we know can evapotranspirate up to 100 gallons of water in a 24-hour period of time. So in essence, why I say trees is because trees actually become our biopumps. Pipes don't work in future sea level rise. I mean, a pipe is underground, and if the water is already saturated and sitting on top of the ground, I mean, where does that go? So you're really going to have to think about the evapotranspirative aspects. And so we talk about that a lot in the ecology section, but we're also talking about the tools, much akin to the periodic table of elements. We lay it out, like all these kind of different strategies that have these technologies. You know, and we're all kids from high school, so I'm always trying to keep it fairly simple of understanding, you know, like the elemental chart. That's why we broke it out into this kind of periodic table. And so you understand the tools and which ones are going to be better for salt water, which ones are going to be better for fresh water, which ones are going to be better for water quality, up to volume, reduction kind of capabilities, and kind of everything in between. And we lay that out. And so from that perspective, it's not just looking at trees, but it's like, then how does that tree become a bioswale? How does it become a constructed wetland? How does it become a living shoreline? How does it, you know, all of these tools that we fundamentally understand, but it's how we can begin to look at those as isolated tools. But then that's where the urban design category comes in, and the understanding of now how do I distribute this all across the landscape as a treatment train, and think about how I integrate it at the scale of a building, at the scale of a site, at the scale of the street, and then within open space networks, and looking at it how it would then work along shorelines. I always thought it was ironic because in Fort Lauderdale we have 330 miles of shoreline edge, but only 5% of that is public land. So this is a tremendous issue that we have to start thinking about, because from an urban design perspective and from an ecological perspective, we've hardened our shoreline. Actually, in Broward County, we're about 90% hardened, and that's more than Miami-Dade at 70%, and that's more than Palm Beach at 60%, and these are the three counties. And then let's not even talk about the Florida Keys and Monroe County, because, you know, they have a whole other set of issues. But, you know, we've hardened the shoreline, so what we're looking at is how do we begin to take these tools and get ecosystem services overlaid in these areas, especially when we're looking at seawalls. And if one neighbor doesn't effectively build up their seawall next to another neighbor that is, you can really create these kind of unlinear consequences of, you know, profound damage to one property versus another. And so what we're trying to explore in there is showing how privatized shoreline needs to be kind of dealing with landscape as infrastructure, and not just looking at hardened shorelines. Because, you know, to raise a seawall, I mean, in most cases, it can be $1,000 a linear foot. In some cases, it can be as cheap as $100, but, you know, we're talking about $1,000 a linear foot. I could put 20 trees in, you know, for, you know, about the same price, if depending on the size and the character of them and what they're doing. You know, and so there's some of those challenges, but we talk through that. But, you know, even in South Florida and Broward County and Fort Lauderdale in particular, we're the boating and yachting capital of the world. People don't want mangroves in their backyard necessarily, and so we have to kind of work through some of those challenges. There's also a reason we didn't have them, or we got rid of them in the first place, because they are a great location to breed mosquitoes, our state bird. You know, and we have to be just kind of brutally honest with how are we going to deal with the state bird. And so, you know, what we're even trying to tool into this book is talking about ecological pest management, and how to kind of sleuth that into our urban design, but also in the ecological design. And so, you know, you have to understand that purple martins, which can eat their weight in mosquitoes in a night or in a day, bats that can also eat mosquitoes. But one of the biggest, most prolific is actually another insect, which is the dragonfly. How do you create dragonfly habitat? Ironically, some butterflies, even some of the endangered ones that we're trying to bring back here, have some critical capacity to deal with this pest. And so we've, you know, I think 100 years ago when we were eradicating these mangrove forests, we didn't have a real understanding of the ecosystem and how those ecosystem services and this kind of synergies between these insects. And so that was a big challenge that we're trying to kind of attack and tackle within this book, is kind of talking about how to bring back some of these ecosystem services. And again, ecosystem services, you know, for some of your listeners who may not kind of understand, there's four basic ones, you know, habitat creation, food production, climate regulation, and, you know, there's flood mitigation or flood protection, you know, and so when we think about those things, we, you know, I think this is going to be more and more the consequence, because that, you know, this kind of drives to what you're asking, and I will get to the architecture, I promise. But it gets to what you're asking about, because it's how do all of these kind of systems tie together and kind of begin to connect. That's going to be the biggest challenge. How do we get ecosystem services within urban services? And urban services, most of us don't think about, but, you know, it's think about the pipe underneath the road. Think about the road itself. That is a piece of urban infrastructure. Think about police, fire, sewer services, all these things that we take for granted, even power, getting to that. And so one of the most profound things that we had discussed in with the city of Fort Lauderdale as well as Broward County, who are also partners on this project, and others at Florida Sea Grant in Gainesville, and even at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which, you know, I can talk about those grants here in a second that were given to this project. But all of these folks had these challenges that we really had to think how these aspects were going to be tied together. And that's why we're trying to bring the science, the engineering, the architecture, landscape architecture, and all of these kind of elements to the table here in thinking about this book. But from an architectural standpoint, you know, it was interesting because, you know, I work in a school of architecture, and so some of these ideas first bore out of Florida Atlantic University. And, you know, my partner Larry Scarpa teaches at University of Southern California. So we use these studios. We also have Keith Vanderreet, Dr. Vanderreet from University of Kansas, that was on this project. And he was originally here at Florida Atlantic, but moved away, and but just prolific, and I could talk about one of his systems, which is called Reef Walls, and why, you know, he was looking at a lot of living shoreline development, but he's also an architect. So we all kind of came together, taught amongst these kind of three studios around the country to really be an incubator to think about a kind of holistic future that we knew these architecture students weren't going to know about the ecosystem or the ecological kind of urban design issues, but we kind of pulled that in. And then we started to kind of bolster it with architectural ideas. How do we begin to think about the building integration? And so there was a lot of unique concepts, but we show in our book, too, a menu that you go from abandonment or when we retreat all the way to, the most robust kind of flood adaptive architecture that you could. And then it's somewhere in between there. You could even move buildings out of the way, right? Because let's be honest, like if we're flooding, you know, you could do a simple thing, move to high ground. Unfortunately, Florida doesn't, and South Florida in particular, doesn't have that that luxury. But, you know, just up the road here, they start to have that luxury because they're much higher ground in Palm Beach, West Palm Beach areas than we are here in Broward and Miami-Dade County. Miami-Dade is ironically about 4 feet above sea level on average, and we're about 3 feet in Broward County. So, and again, don't get me started about Monroe County, but they're like, you know, one of our they're going to have some serious challenges. But, you know, what this looks like when you're just saying a future of 6 feet of sea level rise, let's just say, and quite frankly, I try not to talk in time frames because most people ask me, well, when's 6 feet going to come? Well, you know, based on the current data, 2070, you know, like based on our, because we have something here in South Florida called the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact. And that has a unified projection, sea level rise projection. And so that sea level rise projection gets updated every 5 years, roughly 4 to 5 years. And when I first got here, it said 6 feet by 2100. Well, the last update in 2019 said 6 feet by 2070. I don't even want to see what the 2024 update is going to say, but I can tell you it doesn't look like it will get better. You know, these are going to be kind of challenges. And so that's what we asked the students in the architecture and that kind of menu was how could it address these kind of issues? Because at some point, you're not going to be able to look at fixed structures on the ground. You're not going to look at permanentizing them with foundations and other things. And even if you did, you know, we started to talk about how you would maybe abandon the first floor, becomes, you know, a basement or a flood zone later on, and you kind of move. So, you know, how do we design a building that may have two lobbies, you know, one at the ground floor and one at the second floor, and the second floor lobbies for tomorrow, right? Or how do you just simply do, you know, what seems to be logic and our grandparents' ingenuity, but just, you know, instead of building at 15-foot floor to floor for the ground floor, go to 20. Then you have 5 feet built in to just kind of bring it up over time. And so, you know, we're trying to lay out those kind of simple tools throughout the book to just kind of explain to, again, designers and architects and so on. But I think one of the critical things is also from an architectural perspective we try to lay out in the book is the materials that we're putting in buildings. And, you know, all too often we're seeing, you know, after a hurricane, you know, like there's a, you know, there's usually some amount of days without power. Well, a lot of the materials that we're putting in buildings right now breed mold and mildew, and those are going to become challenges. And, you know, and let's just say if we have to abandon, like I was talking about our partners at Fort Lauderdale, our partners in Broward County, they're having to think about unplanning. And I'll just say, you know, that's a kind of tremendous question and proposition. But, you know, like we had red line districts in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, like we're going to have blue line districts. And I think we're already starting to see these. But these are going to be the neighborhoods that are most vulnerable, that, that we're not going to be able to provide basic services like police and fire services. They're not going to have access to the water supply that we have coming, or the wastewater supply. So we're going to see a lot of decentralization of infrastructure, I think, within neighborhoods and other conditions like that. We're going to see also that if they have to abandon neighborhoods and those neighborhoods essentially become offline, that we should have, just like a city has a planning department, they should have an unplanning department to begin to think about this. And we should have a building code that is also preparing for it, because somebody's not going to go in there with a bulldozer and clean it all up and put something that's going to be there to allow this thing to be a saltwater tidal marsh in the future, right? So you have to be really careful about those materials, so they can't be carcinogenic, they can't be toxic, they're not going to become deleterious to, you know, become even more of a problem from an ecological standpoint beyond just the fact that they're going to become flooded. And so that's a big challenge from an architectural perspective, that we need to start thinking about the age of a building. Like the lifespan of a building is going to be far different. Like we could start to think about 0 to 10 year lifespans versus, you know, 20 to 50 versus 50 to 100. And to tool ourselves as we're thinking about that with where we see the future sea level rise and how high it may come to certain areas. But at the end of the day, still, you're going to have to move between buildings. And so, you know, that's why we're also, we didn't touch on it too heavily in the book, but there's some renderings that kind of give some understanding to this, that we may have to be looking at how do we fly from building to building, or how do we airboat from building to building, because we're not talking about outboard engines with propellers, you know, when the water may not be that high, and then we're fluctuating by these tides where the water could only be 6 inches high. Well, you know, it's better the airboat through that than it is, I think, to slog through it. And you're definitely not going to be driving through it. If you guys saw what happened on April 12th in 2023 here in Fort Lauderdale, where we had 26 inches of rainfall fall in about a 9 hour period of time, which was the most rainfall to ever fall in recorded history in the state of Florida in a single spot. And that's what we would call or refer to now as a rain bomb. And these are going to become more likely events. Well, if you looked at that event, I think they had something around 40,000 car claims just in Fort Lauderdale alone from being flooded out. It also affected, I think, about 4,000 to 5,000 structures were flooded. So, you know, these are going to become more commonplace. I mean, that was what we would call a 1,000-year storm, but I don't even like to call things 100-year storms, 50-year, 500. Like that's old thinking now, because we have to understand the infrastructure of yesterday is not set up for what it needs to be tomorrow. That is going to be the profound change. And so, you know, again, what we lay out in this book, and this will be my last thought to that question, is, you know, essentially, you know, in the future, we're trying to say we're never going to go ahead and stop flooding. That you should just not say we're fighting flooding. What we need to look at is flooding as an asset. It needs to be something that we live with. It needs to be a lifestyle, and it can be a lifestyle choice. Those that don't want to live with, you know, potential of airboats and quadcopters or flood adaptive architecture in the future, well, you know, maybe South Florida is not for you. But I think we have to have some semblance of a settlement that stays here, because there, you know, it's one of the few subtropical regions, and it's the only subtropical region in the continental United States that has some purpose, because of whether that be agricultural, tourists, or others, that's going to be a critical element. And so, you know, that's the whole point of the Salty Urbanism novel is to really understand, you know, what that lifestyle would need to engage around and how to begin the tools and tactics for adapting to it.
Oh man, that was a lot, Jeff. I knew you'd eventually take a breath there, but I was waiting for it to happen. And congratulations on like the longest answer ever recorded. Don't apologize. It was great. I want to dive in here. So this is my personal interest in this started back in 2017, where I was part of a team with Susanna Drake and Rafi Siegel, where we were commissioned by the Regional Plan Association to look at New York and the Bight, where the currents bring there. So we spent a lot of time obviously thinking about like those trade-offs between, where do you adapt? Where do you harden? where do you let the line turn into a zone and that sort of salty urbanism? Where do you retreat? And you have an entire set of typologies as well for this one. So I would love for you to talk a bit more about like how you break down not just the typologies of abandonment, retreat, removal, floating, et cetera, but also the decision apparatus on when you choose which condition for which part of the coast. So how do you provide that decision-making? What are the typologies? And how do you provide the decision-making apparatus for elected leaders or private homeowners on like, so the ocean is coming from you, from underneath you, what do you do now? Yeah, could you break that down for us?
Yeah, you know, and I think it goes back to the ecotypes. We basically said that if it's those upland ridges, you know, these are areas 12 foot and kind of higher in our region, you know, where, you know, and it could even be down to 10 foot and higher. Those make sense for the next, you know, the next stage or the next evolution of development to move forward and kind of in a, I wouldn't say a traditional sense, but overlay it with some of these ecosystem services. That is, again, bioswales and other things that, again, won't allow water to run down to these low-lying areas and exacerbate them. But that decision really needs to be, I think, an elevational decision and an ecotype decision. If you are in one of these transverse glades, you may want to start considering, you know, about, you know, looking at flood, you know, floating architecture, whether that be amphibious or floating. If you're in the Everglades, you may want to also kind of look at that or some sort of host or, you know, a platform for which to build on and begin to kind of build up over. If you're on the barrier island, again, you know, we were looking at transfer of development rights onto the coastal ridge and, again, the higher ground, but moving things out of the more vulnerable areas. So I think it really is an elevation that we should consider, and that's why I didn't want to talk about time, but I think we need to kind of still think about that time, because if we're designing buildings for 50 years, right, if that's what we're supposed to be designing them to, well, you know, we all know it takes, you know, for a building 5 years from design, engineering, funding, financing, building it, you know, it's, so you're looking 55 years out. You should at least be utilizing the latest model to tell you where that height's going to be to make that decision of which of these kind of menu types to use and how that architecture is going to play out. You know, that's one thing. But if it's a piece of infrastructure beyond even the building, if it's like a road, I mean, you need to thinking 60 years out because, you know, in those things, it takes 10 years sometimes to plan, engineer, design, fund, and build. You know, and that's what we're working through is streetscapes right now, parks, all these other, like, that have a lot longer lead time. But if it's a house, if it's some of these others, we really need to kind of consider that. But, you know, you're making a great point because, you know, a lot of the single family homes around us are slabs on grade. Well, these slabs on grade, especially they're, and the sad thing is they're west of I-95. And so again, they're in that Everglades ecotype. And as we're getting more and more profound pressure of sea level rise, keep in mind, that's raising the groundwater. That groundwater only raises higher due to capillary action the further inland it moves. And we have the secondary coastline that most people don't like to think about, which is fundamentally the Everglades to our west. And so these things are putting pressure on those communities. And unfortunately, I think those are the most vulnerable, the ones west of I-95. And these are going to be the areas that are going to be most challenged because, you know, as you have that hydrostatic pressure building up on these slabs on grade, they're going to break, crack. You're going to have tremendous contamination, but also potentially structural issues. Well, you'll definitely have structural issues, but you could have life jeopardizing structural issues in the long run, not to mention the toxic carcinogenic materials that start to get leaching into those waterways. And so, you know, all of those, you know, I know, I mean, to answer this question as short as I can, I think it's the elevation, but I think it's also the communities having to solve and finding for themselves. So one of the things that salty urbanism really tries to call out is working from the neighborhood scale down. It's working, if we as neighborhoods don't think about it as a regional plan, don't think about it as a city plan, think about it as a neighborhood plan down to the streets and that, the blocks, and even the buildings within that neighborhood. Neighborhoods can fundamentally be a small enough unit to make good choices for themselves and to make smart choices, and they're probably going to be the way in which they need to create an economy that's around infrastructure that is that's been decentralized and can be supporting that neighborhood itself. I think those are going to be the challenges and the opportunities that we're going to see in the future. So cities, you know, more and more are going to be tasked. You know, we may not build that centralized stormwater treatment plant or that centralized water treatment plant. That may not be the right way to think about it. We may have to go back and retool cities and urban design and, you know, kind of the way we make things around the neighborhood.
And thinking further about, I mean, it's clear that you've had a discussion at the level of, you know, county and regional government and with planners. And I'm sure that in your architecture work with the practice, you've also had quite a lot of interface with, you know, parks and parks and recreation, for lack of a better overall term. But I'm interested in finding out a little bit, to your point about neighborhoods, you know, what has the interface been like with developers and with the people who are actually putting the money into, you know, kind of either making the choice about doing the things the way we've always done them or doing them in a different way where we have to accept that we're going to move different ways between buildings, or we might have to have mangroves in our channel, or maybe I don't get to have that beachfront property all year round.
Right. No, it's a great question. So, I mean, and I'll use this one project we're working on right now, which is Vista Breeze. It's an elderly affordable housing project in Miami Beach. It's 119 units. It's currently under construction. And the sad thing, and I'll just say this at first, is it's the first affordable, it's the largest affordable housing project built on Miami Beach in the last 40 years at 119 units, if that tells you anything. But this project was designed to be flood adaptive in utilizing some of the tools that came out of salty urbanism. And so, you know, in working with the developer, which, you know, I won't name the developer here just for the sake of the developer, but, you know, you can look this up. I can tell you one of the active partners is the Housing Authority of the City of Miami Beach, which is a public entity. They own the dirt. And so they were very much interested in how to steward the environment, which it was already great to have a developer that, you know, and a partner with the development team that was already thinking in that way. So we knew we wanted the site to operate like a sponge, and we knew it had to be flood adaptive for the future. So the landscape and the plant materials are all what I would kind of consider a guild. They work together in tandem to really become that kind of biopump and a sponge. We also are looking at water exfiltration systems in there and other things that we're trying to clean that water before it goes back down into the aquifer, those kind of aspects to really try to help with the freshwater lens situation that could go away in the future from this. And so if we can get a freshwater lens to maintain on the barrier island, which Miami Beach is on a barrier island, it really helps us in the long term, because once you lose that, you basically have saltwater intrusion and you're not going to have any plants living unless they truly are flood adaptive. And so we were really cognizant of that. But the one thing I would say about the developer, and this is where some of your listeners may get interested in, is, you know, we're looking at the triple bottom line. We are looking at the ecological sense. We're looking at the social sense, and I'll touch on that a little bit here because it's seniors in there and how they shelter in place. And how we're designing to that, but we're, you know, based on the book, but we're also looking at the economics, right? And so the developer, they're worried most about what is this thing going to cost me? And not just necessarily up front. How is this thing going to cost me over the long-term durability, maintenance, and operations? And so we had to be super cognizant of this too. And they went ahead and decided to go through something that's called CLOMR, Conditional Letter of Map Revision, which basically essentially pulls you out of the floodplain. Because I don't know if you know this, but, you know, pretty much all of South Florida is a floodplain. So we have to have flood insurance, especially based on the latest FEMA maps. And to those FEMA maps that do not take into account sea level rise. So it's kind of interesting. But we had to go through this process with them. And essentially, we had to design the building and the infrastructure around us to kind of meet these kind of mandates. And the critical part of that was it saves us on flood insurance. These projects were going to cost about $1 million in flood insurance a year. It going through this process is going to be about $100,000 a year. So you tell me what developer is not going to sit there and say, you mean I can save 900% of my flood insurance costs, let alone, you know, like have a more resilient, sustainable building? That seems to be a no-brainer. And two, these only cost us maybe $500,000 in design of the infrastructure to serve that. So it already is going to pay for itself in the first year, right? I mean, that's like an economic no-brainer that most people should kind of think about. You know, we have to go through what's called the LOMER process once it gets built, which is the letter of map revision. So, you know, you go through the conditional, which is just looking at the drawings, FEMA. It's looked at FEMA up in Washington, D.C., and their consultant. And then the floodplain manager of the community looks at it. And then once we get it built, they come back out and they look at it and ensure that everything was installed, built correctly to that kind of T. And I can get into that detail a little bit more, but that, I would say, was one of the biggest draws with our developer, you know, from the standpoint of this particular project. But we had to add other things into this project to make it more resilient from a social standpoint. If you remember Hurricane Irma, back in 2018, I believe it was, when it came up the center of the state, you know, we had these huge challenges where the Florida Building Code, you know, in some cases in buildings doesn't allow, or at least people don't want, operable windows. Well, you get into a profound issue, especially when you have no power and after a hurricane, and you can't open up a window. Well, Hollywood, Florida had about 10 deaths of elderly, you know, if you recall that during that storm, because it wasn't the storm that killed them. It was the fact that they weren't able to open a window, or at least that window wasn't designed to open up enough to really create a passive design cooled building. And so we fundamentally designed these projects for passive cooling. We've oriented them and opened them up to prevailing breezes from the southeast. We've opened them up to also have, you know, cross ventilation through the units themselves, through transoms above the doorways and out the windows. And we've also kind of added generators and other things on there. And we've had to put them up on the roof as well as the fuel tank, because, again, you don't want that stuff on the ground because it will flood out. So, you know, there's some added structure we had to think about. But all of this had to be kind of discussed, talked about, kind of work through with the developer to ensure that they understood why we were making decisions that were for the best interest of the project. Because Hurricane Irma also taught us another lesson, especially if you're trying to evacuate the entire state, because that thing was coming straight up the center, is that you can't get everybody out. It creates such a pull on the system and such a you know, essentially challenges in there where there's so much traffic and people that couldn't even get out of the state, even if they tried, even before the hurricane hit. It was phenomenal. And, you know, and that's like a once in a lifetime storm, or maybe twice in a lifetime storm. But if you look at this year, they're saying this is going to be the most active hurricane season. But, you know, these elderly are meant to shelter in place. So, you know, the whole ground floor is meant to flood out. We have no, there's a few units on the ground floor, but, you know, these units are up to what we call they're in Miami-Dade County, or in Miami Beach in particular. They did something smart a few years back. They decided to establish, or at least the developer establishes, the finished floor height over base flood elevation. So essentially, our freeboard, we're allowed to do 1 foot over base flood elevation up to 5 feet. And that has no impact on our building height. It's once we've established that finished floor elevation, which is called the design flood elevation, once we establish that, that's where our height is then dictated from. Not a lot of communities do that, and they're starting to fix that codes, because, you know, basically a lot of them say, you know, it's 1 foot over, you know, 18 inches of crown of road, or 1 foot over base flood elevation. But if I want to be a more resilient house and build 5 feet above it, why can't I do it? But then if my code tells me I'm limited to 20 feet, right, how do I get, you know, if I want to go 10 foot above it, then, you know, I only get 10 foot of floor area, or floor to floor area, right? And so it becomes a challenge on the building height. But Miami Beach was one of the first to really allow for this flexibility in theirs. And so, you know, we built basically 2 foot over base flood elevation for these projects. And so that's where those units sit. We also have lobbies that kind of sit there, but we've also designed the parking to be at 8 foot. So you already have, and then the site is at 4.5 feet, but they're planning to build the roads up to 6 feet in 5 years. So like how we've kind of designed the whole system is so now we can understand and have this future adapted to where the street will eventually be with our building kind of working in tandem. So it's all kind of added up and tied together, which is, you know, I think where the future of architects are going to have to kind of think through in these areas. And that's the thing is I think these are partnerships, truly interdisciplinary partnerships that must happen between the architects, the landscape architects, the planners, the urban designers, but the civil engineers, the mechanical, electrical, plumbing engineers, the structural engineers. And I mean, one last note I'll say on this project is, you know, and this goes back to the economics and the developer, is we understood where Smartly put rebar and where to put galvanized rebar. I would love to use fiberglass. I would love to use even basalt fiber reinforcing, but we're not allowed to right now in the Florida Building Code. It looks like we're just going to be starting to build that in Florida Department of Transportation, which is not usually somebody I celebrate. Sorry for anybody that's from Florida Department of Transportation listening. But they've been using them in bridges, and I think we're going to finally see allow for the structural engineering of concrete structures utilizing these alternative reinforcement aspects. But we chose to use galvanized rebar in the ground floor, so the first floor up to the second floor. Then it goes to standard rebar above that, and it's standard rebar below that. And the reason it's standard rebar below that is because essentially we're sitting right on the water table, and it's going to be fully saturated all the time. So if something's fully saturated, it doesn't rust. You know, I'll just put it like that. But if it is in these kind of littoral zones where you have ebbs and flows, right, high tide, low tide, storm surge, not storm surge, that's where we have the biggest challenge. And so that's where we went with galvanized, which, you know, has 2 to 3 times the cost over standard rebar. And then we went to standard rebar above that because we looked at it and said, well, the age and the infrastructure is intended to live 60 years on this building. So the sea level rise will never get high enough to that until this apartment building has seen its, you know, its useful lifespan. And so, you know, that's, and we also raise the courtyard to this thing at the second floor. And so that becomes the main community space, essentially. And so, you know, if it does start flooding out in the future, like basically the whole ground floor floods out, the parking garage becomes, essentially a parking area for boats, you know, or something like that. And that's the kind of transitional and transformative and kind of adaptive thinking that I think we're pulling from what we learned in Salty Urbanism and applying it to some of the context, which I know wasn't touching on parks, but, you know, and I can go into that because, you know, we're finishing some of that. But you know, that's, I think the developers are driving a lot of the conversations around these elements.
Well, I mean, you're definitely continuing in the proud Brooks and Scarpa tradition of working with a lot of nonprofits and municipally owned developers for underserved communities in very challenging conditions. They probably do, though, have a better attitude toward future stewardship of the land and the surrounding community than, say, your average speculative developer. I just wonder, you know, when is the tide, so to speak, going to turn, you know, where these folks who are kind of just doing the bare minimum, you know, with how they're paving the site or how they're following the Army Corps of Engineers directions from, you know, 50 years ago. When are they going to get convinced that they need to do Salty Urbanism? It kind of sounds like the argument about flood insurance might be the thing that actually turns them over. If you could really show that there's an economic advantage, like right off the top of the pro forma, to do that.
And yeah, building off that, Jeff, I mean, what has been the reaction from these communities so far? Because I feel like there's a long history, and we did this for the RPA in New York and New Jersey. Like, you know, you do the conceptual exercises, you develop the toolkits, and then you run into homeowner reticence and local electeds who will afraid they'll be voted out of office. Like, yeah, where are the institutional levers to really make this happen? Because so many great efforts like this have just run aground, so to speak, on just like intractable local opposition.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, I'll touch on that last part of the question, I think, because what was funny is when we created these plant pallets, I would go around presenting them in the community. I went to Hollywood, was one of the communities, which is just south of us here in Fort Lauderdale. It's like right on the line between Miami-Dade and Broward County. And, you know, one of the most telling things was when I was presenting, I showed, you know, again, the plant pallets, and I had a homeowner taking photographs. And I was like, and, you know, why are they taking photographs? So I was curious. I was like, I was assuming that they're like, hey, these are, you know, I didn't know. Anyways, I walked up to them and they go, I'm tired of spraying fresh water on my lawn 2 times a day during king tides, right? When the salt water is just kind of riding over it and they have to sit there and go out sometimes at midnight and then at noon in the middle of the day and the heat of the day to just hose down to make sure their turf grass doesn't die. So he's like, I want to look at a turf grass alternative, right? I want to look at tree alternatives so my stuff doesn't keep dying. You know, so there's something just so practical as that, that I think homeowners are accepting of salty urbanism from that standpoint of just, look, I may not be able to do like some of these things that will be very costly, but this is the one thing I know because I want to have a nice presentation. I want to understand this. And I think that, you know, one of those things when I talk about this is the fact that we are not promoting landscape as ornamentation. This landscape becomes infrastructure. And when you start to think about that and you put the fact that a pipe, think about that like beer, right? Beer has a shelf life. Its age, it doesn't taste very good after a few years, and I would not advise to drink it. But where plants, especially the right plants in the right kind of guild or the right kind of habitation, you know, create what you would think is more like wine, right? It gets better with time and better with age, and they work better. And so if we can shift that thinking amongst the populace or amongst our public that we serve as architects, as designers, that's been what's truly, I think, novel about salty urbanism is that they can galvanize around those things. Now, you know, flipping back to the other side and trying to get these baked into policy and code and zoning and other things, that's also been a huge challenge. But we're getting things codified slowly. You know, and this is where you're asking that question about why, well, let me just say it like this. We need to understand that, first of all, building codes and ordinances are usually the bare minimum. They're like, you know, if I'm taking a test and I meet them, I've made a C, meaning that C minus is failing, right, in most of our world this day. But we also have a problem where we can't sometimes mandate things, right? But you can incentivize, you can make things benefits, right? So and what we're looking at now, especially the conversation I had with AI in Miami a couple weeks back and with their resiliency officer at the county, what they're really trying to do is create a slew of benefits. How do you begin to incentivize people to do even more above and beyond the bare minimum? And they're doing that by either expediting code review or, you know, your permitting review process. They're doing that by expediting, you know, or even removing the costs of some of those burdens. And I think until we actually start charging those for doing the bare minimum more than those that are doing right, you're not going to see the market change because we all know that it does cost more in most cases to do the right thing. But this is the other challenge is in salty urbanism, we're noticing in some of the projects I've been working on at Brooks Scarpa, we're noticing that we're having to build a lot of redundancy where we shouldn't be having to build redundancy in it. Like we should be able to do this landscape as infrastructure and not rely so much on the pipes and the exfiltration trenches and some of these other things if we can show that the modeling works, but we're not being allowed to do it because, you know, some of this is baked into it. So we're going to have to see policies change, right? And that's one of the biggest influences I think we try to do at Brooks Scarpa is policy is the next stage, as well as what I would see urbanism, getting the things right from that neighborhood scale, but it's also the policies to allow for us to do the right thing.
Well, I take you as an eternal optimist, Jeffrey, for thinking about all the different strategies of how people can remain and keep a community in challenged landscapes like South Florida. And you've transitioned us from discussion of my two favorite things, architecture and urbanism, to my two other favorite things, beer and wine. I love the metaphors. I really want to thank you for spending the time telling us in such a great level of detail how you conceived of salty urbanism and how you're hoping that this will take root in the lands that are most challenged by sea level rise. It's certainly one of the biggest problems of our age. That's Jeffrey Huber, and he's at Brooks and Scarpa, and in partnership with Florida Atlantic University, has authored Salty Urbanism, a design manual to address sea level rise and climate change for urban areas in the coastal zones. Quite a subtitle there. Thanks for joining us in Unfrozen.